From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, the state of Wisconsin prepares to set parameters for its second wolf hunt. Plus, a Milwaukee woman takes on one of the loudest arguments against homeschooling, the socialization of kids.
My kids are in what I would say is a natural way to socialize. So we are out and they interact with children of all ages, adults of all ages, and that's real.
A group works to provide mentors for people diagnosed with breast cancer, and musician Sean Rosch explains how he happens to be musician Sean Rosch.
You could say that's the one thing I stuck to, and I never gave up. I've tried a lot of things like, skateboarding or school, but nothing really stuck, but music always has.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The clock is ticking ever closer to Wisconsin's still hotly debated second wolf harvest. After its federal endangered status was lifted in January of 2012, the state quickly drafted a wolf hunt law. In what critics complained was the blink of an eye, Wisconsin carried out its first wolf harvest. At this hour, the DNR's recently formed Wolf Advisory Committee is huddled in a conference room in Wausau, charged with setting this season's harvest quota. As their committee deliberates, two UW-Madison scientists will share their 14 years of research. Geography Professor Lisa Naughton and Environmental Studies Associate Professor Adrian Trevis have and continue to survey Wisconsin residents to glean public opinion on wolf policy and management. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz reached them as they prepared to address the committee.
This Wolf Advisory Committee has a lot of newcomers on it, and they won't be familiar with our research. So we're going to give that 13-year historical overlook of state residents' attitudes and then try to make some policy recommendations about not fixating on a single number for the statewide population, but rather focusing on reducing conflicts and considering the local situation that makes people intolerant of wolves.
Were you at that last meeting, or you've received feedback on public comment?
We had a representative from my lab there, Jamie Hogberg.
Your colleague came back with what kind of a message?
A message that the issue of our surveys and questionnaires of public opinion had come up spontaneously from the public present at the first meeting, and that now our research is being invoked by certain groups. And so we sort of need to represent our own work because sometimes it's being interpreted differently than we think is appropriate.
How do you encapsulate 13 years of research?
That there's more common ground among Wisconsin residents than what might appear to be the case if you just go to public meetings. The public meetings tend to draw the most outspoken and sometimes polarized views. Most of the state agrees we should have some wolves. Most of the state agrees we probably need to keep a cap on how big that population is. Most agree that there should be some kind of compensation or protection for livestock producers so that they don't lose livestock on their private land. There's even consensus that hunting is an acceptable part of management. The disparities and the controversies come up more in terms of how many wolves should be hunted, how should they be hunted, where they should be hunted. And a troubling and fuzzy part of the whole policy debate is there's a recognition that we have to control conflict, that is depredation on livestock by wolves, but there's sort of a leap that state-level hunts are going to be the best way to reduce those conflicts.
If I could add to that, there's an assumption that the more wolves the state has, the more conflict there will be. But an equally plausible explanation is that the wolves have spread into areas that are more heavily populated by people and by livestock. And it's that geographic spread that's been increasing conflict.
13 years of study is substantial. Are there gaps, or do you think part of your message is, let's talk more about what we do know and consider that as decisions are made in this second harvest and beyond?
We still see pretty big gaps in knowledge that are hindering policy, if as a society we aspire to policy that's based on evidence so that it's not based so much on opinion and anecdote, then there's still some really important questions out there, such as what does the state as a whole feel? What's a representative sample of the state's attitudes towards wolves and wolf policy? We've seen the pendulum swing back and forth in wolf policy with one group after another being angry at the shifts in policy, but there's still that silent majority out there who sometimes seem to be watching and waiting, and other times they speak out, and they have yet to be heard and measured in a systematic way. So we're going to call for that kind of a study, especially now that the Wolf Advisory Committees have been formally established and they're obligated to do important things like set quotas and determine hunting zones, and in fact determine the methods in which wolf hunting might be pursued. So we think there are big questions out there about what's acceptable to the public, given that we are all owners of the wolves in our state. So we're going to try to cover everything we know about attitudes across the state, but with the caveat that we don't have a representative sample of the entire state. And so we'll point to the need for research that is truly representative, you know, given that we're living in a democratic society and wolves are a public trust resource.
Is there an element of your research that you feel is most pertinent to decisions that need to be made now?
Yeah, we have data on approval and disapproval for methods of hunting, and given the current political direction that the DNR is taking towards the wolf harvest, we think they should probably pay close attention even amongst residents of Wolf Range who would be the less tolerant towards wolves. There's some pretty clear signals about what methods they would approve and what methods they would approve for wolf hunting, and also some of the decisions about hunting to control depredations. I think we need to scrutinize those carefully and really determine if hunting has in fact reduced conflict between private property owners and wolves, or if we're not quite doing what we need to be doing to reduce those conflicts.
The public has given us the green light to go forward with a hunt with the understanding that the hunt is necessary to control depredation. But the devil is in the details. Hunting where and how many wolves, how does that relate to what kind of depredation and conflicts are out there? Just a sort of a, we have to hunt more wolves to reduce conflicts. That kind of general statement is no longer acceptable. We have to become more sophisticated about tailoring the hunt to meet that public sanction goal, which is to keep wolves around but reduce conflicts.
You say that armed with the research and surveys and focus groups that weighed in on this issue through the years. Is that correct?
Yeah, in particular, let me quote one of the statistical findings that we have. That's from our statewide survey in 2004. Well, I shouldn't say statewide. It just covered 6 zip codes, 3 of them inside Wolf Range and 3 outside of Wolf Range. So when we asked, do you believe there should be a public hunting and trapping season on wolves in Wisconsin, from over 1,300 residents of our state, as I said, 3 zip codes inside Wolf Range and 3 zip codes outside of Wolf Range, the plurality, which means the highest proportion, said yes, but only when depredations become unmanageable. So we believe the state first has to demonstrate that depredations have become unmanageable, and then secondly, indicate that the way they've designed the hunting season will address that problem.
The state has had its first harvest. We'll be moving into the second. There have been big shifts from working to encourage the repopulation of wolf packs, moving from a scientific advisory committee to, I think, what's called a wolf management advisory committee. You know, how do you feel about what's happening so far?
Well, my scientific opinion is that it has been fast, and some of the policy interventions have been done without collecting the necessary baseline data so that we can assess the effectiveness of the policy. And that always concerns me as a scientist. One of my specialties is intervention planning, and when I speak about interventions, I include the regulated harvest, the lethal control actions, etc., any steps taken by the managers and the policymakers to manage wolves directly on the ground. And so my concern is that some of the interventions that have been put in place in 2012 were done at such a speed and such a urgency that scientists and wildlife managers alike were unable to collect the necessary information so that 1 year later we can ask the question, did it work? And that's a crucial question because we don't want to waste taxpayer money. On the subject of wasting taxpayers' money, let's remember that the state and federal government collaborated to help wolves recover in Wisconsin, and it was at a tremendous expense. So a precipitous decline in the wolf population would not only be a waste of that past investment, but would trigger a lot of concern that the federal government would step in again and relist wolves. Lisa, do you want to add to that?
That's a scenario that we very much want to avoid.
UW-Madison researchers Lisa Naughton and Adrian Trevis were both members of the Wolf Scientific Advisory Committee, which was disbanded when the wolf was removed from the endangered list in Wisconsin. They spoke with Susan Bentz. Their team has carried out extensive research around public attitudes on wolf policy and management and is currently juggling three related studies. Today's meeting of the DNR's current Wolf Advisory Committee will result in hunt quota recommendations slated to be reviewed by the Natural Resources Board in June, with the wolf hunt season slated to begin on October 15th. We will talk about the practical challenges in homeschooling when Lake Effect returns after a break on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. This morning, Milwaukee home learners are gathered at the Linden Sculpture Gardens for a homeschool day themed Metamorphosis. The attendees expected at the event represent just under 2% of the state's student homeschool population. According to the Department of Public Instruction, about 18,000 kids learned at home last school year. That's compared to the over 850,000 students who received a public instruction and about 125,000 enrolled in traditional private schools. To explore homeschooling, Lake Effect's Amy Kiley spoke with Janine Pufall of the Milwaukee Area Home Learners. Pufall explained why she and other parents choose to teach their children at home.
We're an eclectic group. We all come to homeschooling for various reasons. We were in school, my family, my son was in school, and in a great school, wonderful teachers, safe, but it wasn't the right fit for him. He needed to be outside. He needed to be moving. And I needed him to be with his newborn sister, who he hardly got to see. So that was our decision. Other reasons might be school. Is that the right fit?
Do some people go for religious reasons? What's the correlation between religion and homeschooling?
You know, I can't speak for that. I would imagine that's definitely true. Homeschoolers are considered private education, and we are more expensive than public schooling, but we're cheaper than it costs less to homeschool than it does for private education. So that's probably many families' decisions.
That was one of my questions, too, the financial choices involved. You said that it costs less than private school education, but does it often prevent a family member from working, and what are the trade-offs with that?
Well, there is loss of income for some families if the mom has been working and decides to homeschool, but many families continue to have two working parents in the house. It costs probably, and again, this varies, at the very most, maybe $1,000 per student for curriculum. And that's if you are buying the entire curriculum and maybe doing some things, video classes online. We spend, as a family, about $200 per student on curriculum. So that's not very expensive.
You said that sometimes both parents will continue to work while homeschooling their kids as well. How does that function practically?
The women I know who do work, they work part-time. They might work evenings, or their husbands have a flexible schedule that allows them to work during the day. It's just all over the board.
Once a parent or guardian opts for homeschooling, what legal requirements do they have to meet?
Well, we all have to register with the Department of Public Instruction to let them know that we're homeschooling, that we're a home-based private school. And then there are requirements that we have to meet. Wisconsin has wonderful homeschooling laws, and that they hold us accountable, yet it gives us so many rights and flexibilities as a family. We need to meet 875 hours of instruction per year, and that's the same with any private school. And we have to teach reading, writing, math, science, social studies, and health. And then we can teach a variety of things that meet the 875 hours. So that could be religion, it could be art, it could be music, it could be volunteering. It's very flexible.
That's interesting, the flexibility. What kinds of academic materials do you use in order to convey that education to the kids?
And that is so variable, that by family to family. You, as a homeschooler, can buy an entire curriculum to cover all of those subjects that I just mentioned that by law we have to meet. Or you can create your own curriculum based upon your child's interests. So in our family, we have a math curriculum, and then we are really sort of all over the board with what we use for our other studies.
What about assessment? Do you have to give tests to the state in some way, or do you have to somehow prove that completion of the courses has taken place?
No, that's a very good question. We don't. Wisconsin is unique in that we don't have to test our students. And as an outsider, that might cause some alarm because people do ask me very often, how do I know that my kids' needs are being met? How do I know that they're on par? And we are so fortunate because I have three children, so I have a 1-to-3 ratio. I know where my students are. They're not one of 25 in a classroom where they might have to be tested. I'm with them every day, all day, so I know where they're at.
And what is a normal day of home-based education like?
Again, so variable. One, I would say it's fun. Probably across the board, it's fun for my kids and for me. In our family, it starts off very slowly with the kids making breakfast and waking up when they want to wake up. And then they sort of get to choose what they want to take care of first, if it's practicing their instruments, getting to their math. We are so fortunate in the city to have so many good programs offered by all the different nature centers. Linden Sculpture Gardens has homeschool classes, Discovery World. So very often our days, we're out taking classes, or they're taking classes. My only requirements in a day are that we play and we read a lot.
What happens when a child reaches advanced calculus or physics, especially for parents who might not have a college degree? How do they tackle such advanced subjects?
Well, I think we tackle subjects at all levels. And I feel so fortunate as a homeschooling mom that I get to learn basically with my children. It's so exciting. But when it becomes physics or advanced calculus, which is definitely beyond my reach and many of us, at that point, so many children that homeschool are self-directed. They have figured their way out through addition, subtraction, multiplication. So when it's time to tackle calculus, they're ready for it. And we have, fortunately, the internet, Khan Academy. We can do lectures through Khan Academy, tutors are available, and my kids have their father, so that's great.
How do parents ensure homeschool kids develop normal social skills without routine interaction with peers?
I would question what normal is, and I guess the norm has been established by school, and we have to ask ourselves, is that what everyone wants, and if everybody wants to socialize in that way? I would argue that an introverted boy or girl, probably for them, that socialization isn't the right kind of socialization. But my kids are in what I would say is a natural way to socialize. So we are out and they interact with children of all ages and adults of all ages. And that's real. It's not just children that are solely their age. And again, we are so lucky in the city to have so many wonderful homeschooling opportunities. And then we create our own opportunities. My kids are part of a co-op that meets at my house. We are in a great support group, Milwaukee Area Home Learners. I usually have to pull back because there are so many opportunities for them to be out and meeting people and being with their friends.
What happens when it comes time to apply for colleges in terms of assessment and applications?
Well, I am not at that point, but I have some friends who are, and it's definitely a learning process. But as a homeschooler, we do have to take ACT, SAT. One should look at what schools they want to go to and what they require. because, as you know, most universities are a little bit different, and they have to fill out transcripts. Some homeschoolers do a narrative transcript, which reads probably more like a story of what they've done for the past 4 years, 9 through 12. And others do academic transcripts. The parents come up with grades, the number of hours that they spent per subject. It's pretty much the same route. But universities are used to us, homeschoolers, and in the admissions, many universities have an individual who looks at homeschoolers.
And for listeners who might have only been exposed to school-based education, what aspects of homeschooling might be surprising?
People are surprised at how social we are, that we really are not at home very much. I think people expect that what we do at home is duplicate a brick and mortar or a traditional school, that I sit down with my kids and they're at the table and we go through math and reading and all the subjects and we're there from 8 to 3. And that's not the case. People wonder all the time, how can you do that? Well, I don't. Learning is very fluid and it's organic and, you know, we're learning outside. Our day is quite unique, and it can't even be compared to traditional school.
Well, Janine Pufall of Milwaukee Area Home Learners, thanks for being on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
Janine Pufall is with the Milwaukee Area Home Learners, and she teaches her three children privately. She spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley. Links to information about Pufall's organization and the Linden Sculpture Gardens homeschool days are at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another break now, and in just a moment, a support group seeks to provide mentorship for patients dealing with breast cancer and their families. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Much of the public effort surrounding breast cancer involves raising money for research and awareness. But for people who are diagnosed with the disease and their families, the needs are often much more personal. A Milwaukee-based organization is building national momentum through its effort to provide personal mentorship to breast cancer patients and their loved ones. Mark Young is the president of the organization known as ABCD, After Breast Cancer Diagnosis. He's the first man to head the group, and he was with us in March to explain its unique approach to support. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's really an honor to be here at Lake Effect. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're delighted to have you. We hear a lot about support for patients going through disease, whether it's breast cancer or any other disease. But the word that jumps out at me in the description of ABCD is mentorship. What does it mean to be a mentor in this context?
Mentorship is the signature service of ABCD, and our mission is to provide personalized one-to-one support for patients, families, and friends who are affected by breast cancer. We believe, and our founder, Melody Wilson, back in 1999, who started the organization, believed that one-on-one support from somebody who has a similar experience is extremely helpful to the process. So what we have developed is a program that provides free, personalized, one-to-one support for folks affected by breast cancer. And what we do is we match participants – that's the word we use to describe the people who seek our services – with our mentors who are volunteers, who are all breast cancer survivors, or we have family members who have been affected, to provide support. And that comes in many ways: advice, answering questions, guidance to resources.
Well, right. I was going to ask what a mentorship – I mean, it seems clinical to call it a mentorship session. But what are the kinds of things that someone who is just going through, maybe has just been diagnosed, when she sits down with a mentor and talks, what are the kinds of topics that come up?
Well, it really depends on the individual situation, and each patient's situation is unique. And that's one of the most important things about our service. We have over 300 mentors who are survivors who have been trained. to provide support services. We find out information from a participant, someone who's seeking our help, and if they are interested in a mentorship service, we then match their situation through our database with somebody of a similar age, similar economic circumstance, family circumstance, diagnosis, locale, and these kinds of things, so that the participant can have somebody who's gone through a very similar circumstance. The kinds of things that come up are wide-ranging. Now, of course, we don't provide professional medical advice. That's done by the medical treaters. However, we can refer people to resources. We can talk about how other folks have gone through the many decisions that have to be made. Some are treatment decisions. Should I have chemotherapy? Should I not? Should I have reconstructive surgery? Should I not? And these kinds of things. Plus, the juggling of many of life's challenges, family, relationships, and those kinds of things.
You mentioned the founding of the organization, more than 15 years ago. Tell me the story of how the group came to be.
Well, many people, I'm sure, of the listeners know who Melody Wilson was. She was one of our city's most remarkable broadcast journalists. And Melody was diagnosed with breast cancer in the late 1990s, and many of us have heard the story. She found that while she had friends and family to resort to, there wasn't a real place to get a lot of answers about how can I manage through this, you know, issue of breast cancer. So she decided to create ABCD, and she's the one who conceived of the idea of personalized one-to-one support. And through her friendships and finding out information about other breast cancer survivors, she created the organization.
I imagine you probably get this question or observation a lot. People are probably surprised to hear there is a man who heads the organization today.
Well, I'm very proud and honored that I was recently chosen by our board to be the president. I am the first male president, and I was honored when I was invited to join the board about 4 years ago. I was the first man on the board. Obviously, and we now have several others, including Wayne Oldenburg and Bill Bazan, who are prominent people. The organization obviously is dedicated to breast cancer, which is dominated by female breast cancer. Only 2 to 4% of breast cancer diagnoses are men. But we do provide services for men. And so it's really an honor. I have to say that the board, which is primarily women, is one of the most impressive group of activists and business people that I've ever worked with.
I gather this was a group that was important to your wife as well?
Yes. My wife was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1999, and she's passed away in 2005. And the way we got involved with ABCD was that Erica and I, when we were with her doctor, Alonzo Walker out at Fredert, his nurse, Anna Purdy, had heard about ABCD and suggested that to us. And Erica contacted them and did get services from ABCD, which was a new organization. And what happened was that she had a rare type of breast cancer, inflammatory breast cancer. And as I recall, there were no mentors with that type of cancer at that time. And so she volunteered and became one of the original mentors through ABCD. And our family continued its support of ABCD. And after she passed and I continued our support, I was invited to join the board. And I'm very lucky.
Was her story of how she found and how, I guess, you found the organization, is that common? Is that where people are generally referred? There's someone in their medical team that's heard about the work of ABCD?
That's a great question, because it helps us get the word out how people can find out about us. Of course, we have a website now. It's abcdbreastcancersupport.org, I think. And it's out there for everybody to find out a lot of information about that. But we have built relationships with medical providers and hospitals, and we continue to do that to try to create a situation where the medical providers inform newly diagnosed patients of our services. That can happen in a couple of ways. One might just be handing out a brochure. On the other hand, we do have some relationships with some hospitals where they actually offer to seek the consent of the patient to provide the name of the patient to us, and then we can contact them. The other way that we're contacting people is that just this last year, and this is one of the most exciting developments for ABCD, which we've had a growth plan. We want to be a national organization and reach everybody nationally, and now we do through many states because of the internet and the phone systems. But about 6 or 8 months ago, an organization called YME, that's letter Y hyphen M-E, which was a breast cancer support system located in Chicago, they went out of business. And they had a national helpline 24/7. And we learned of that through our staff and our board of directors and aggressively sought to acquire those assets, and we have acquired those assets. So we have now a we're not up 24/7 yet, but it's 5 days a week, 9 to 5, with our national helpline.
And I imagine with hope, if not plans, for growing beyond that?
Well, we're going to go 24/7. Our strategic plan says that we'll have that completed by December of this year, January of 14 at the latest. We've also added numerous volunteers. There were a large number of YME was staffed by breast cancer survivors. And so the object is to have a national helpline. And through that also to offer our mentoring services, the one-on-one support.
How common is it for people who have been helped by ABCD to turn around and then become mentors themselves? And how great is the need at this point?
Well, that's something that we take a lot of pride in. We have a large percentage of participants who decide to become mentors. And this happens over and over again. And it just builds the entire support network.
And is there – I mean, is that something that you – I mean, it's a strange word, but actively recruit for? As someone is being helped, does someone give them a friendly nudge and say, you know, we would love to have you on as a mentor as well?
I think that can happen. However, that's not part of the mentoring plan.
Sure.
Our plan is to provide the participant with the service they need. And, you know, that depends a lot on the participant and their contacts with us and so forth. I think most of the time it happens because the participant sees the value of the service and what they get out of it and decides to try to help others.
What makes you feel best about this work?
I think the most important thing about working with ABCD is that the personalized one-on-one support, which we call the power of one-to-one, makes a huge difference in the lives of the patients and the families or the friends who are involved. Of course, the medical treatment and the clinical care is absolutely critical. But anybody who's diagnosed with breast cancer or any kind of cancer goes through a lot, a strong sense of isolation. And the one-to-one support can make a big difference in that. We know that contact with through our mentorship program helps improve treatment compliance. We often have – people are afraid of lots of the treatments, and talking to somebody who's been through it can reduce that fear, and that helps with survival. Additionally, reducing stress is critical. There's a lot of studies that show that depression is a serious problem with cancer diagnosis. Post-traumatic stress disorder can be involved. And through support early on to help people see their way through the process makes a huge difference. And so helping people is what we're trying to do.
Well, Mark Young, thanks so much for your work and thanks so much for telling us about it.
Well, thank you, Mitch, and thanks to everybody here at WUWM and Lake Effect. It's been a real pleasure, and we appreciate it.
It's our pleasure indeed. Thanks. Mark Young is president of the Milwaukee-based After Breast Cancer Diagnosis, or ABCD. There's a link to the group's website and its national helpline phone number from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Young is also an attorney at the law firm of Habish, Habish & Rotier. One last break, and then another in a series of Lake Effect interns prepares for an album launch. We'll get a preview of the new CD, Twin Brother, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It is not an official requirement of Lake Effect interns that they be aspiring musicians, but it sure doesn't hurt, and it just often turns out that they are. Following in the wake of such luminaries as Trapper Shep and Paul Schwarzkopf, Sean Rosch and his band Twin Brother are getting set to launch their new self-titled CD with a show tomorrow night at Club Garibaldi. The song we're hearing now is called Overwhelming from the CD. Rosch tries not to attach a particular label to the music, but if nothing else, it can certainly be termed indie rock. Rosch tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about his own musical journey.
I've just been playing music and have been into music generally since I was a little boy. So I was always interested in learning how to play music any way I could. When I was young, it was mainly just singing. I sang over, you know, like Boys to Men cassette tapes, Michael Jackson and all that kind of neat stuff when I was a little kid, you know. But that turned into me trying to, you know, get a guitar and learn how to play. And it was very frustrating for a while, as is any instrument and, you know, learning how to play it. But I guess you could say that's the one thing I stuck to and I never gave up. I've tried a lot of things like, you know, skateboarding or school. but nothing really stuck, but music always has. And so I'm one to just go with what sticks and what's organic to my nature. So
why didn't you stick with the pop genre?
With the pop genre?
Yeah, I'm singing Michael Jackson and whatnot from your childhood.
I don't know. I would have to say life jaded me a little bit, and life isn't pop music. So, again, that's not really organic or natural to me, I guess.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what style would you say that you've developed into, or singer-songwriter sound, if you will?
The track that I'm going to play is off our new record, off Twin Brothers' new record, and it's played acoustically on the album. It's a very intimate song, I would say, and it's just with a Spanish guitar and vocals. It's kind of folk-driven, I think. But yeah, and as well as the rest of the record, I think is kind of folky. Indie folk, as the cool kids say.
As the hipsters say.
Yeah.
Indie folk. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think about all the... I mean, do you have to label it? Does it even mean anything? I mean...
I don't like labeling at all. I think the second you put a label on it and people hear that label before they get a chance to hear you, they've already judged you in some shape or form. So I hate the labeling, but I suppose it's somewhat necessary because audibly, how can you get across an idea without putting a label on it unless you're, you know, just playing it live? So
I've asked this to a few musicians before about labeling. I'm wondering, because at some point you're going to be forced to label yourself, right? I mean,
sure.
Not just me asking you, but for example, your album, your release, it's got to be labeled somehow and put somewhere. So
yeah.
How do you go about that? I mean, because, you know, I mean, you can get yourself into this weird corner, I think, when you're creating music or composing music. Do you feel like you have to create for that style, that label?
No, I try and definitely not do that. I try and just create to what I enjoy playing, I guess, and what's natural to me and what feels good to play and sounds good to my ear. But you're right, you do have to label that at some point. And a perfect example of that is just uploading it to you know, Bandcamp or whatever, and they require you to put a tag on it. You know, well, what do you got to tag this as? Alternative, indie rock, indie folk, a cappella? You know, so you got to pick something, because if you don't, then people aren't going to find your stuff because they're typing in the search box, you know, what they want to hear or whatever. So I always just go with folk or indie, but I don't really know what to label it as.
Okay.
So,
well,
I don't know if that's accurate.
Tell us about the song you're going to perform.
That song is kind of, I would say I wrote it about my general life in music in a 3-second song. It's just about being a local musician that, I guess, in the whole spectrum of the world and entertainment, really no one knows who you are or really cares. And that's just kind of what it's about. But that doesn't mean that there's no passion or emotion or something important, you know, that I have to say. So I guess it's generally about that. And the main line in that song, up on stage with a mask and no name, it's kind of the big line in that song that really describes it. So,
and you're not wearing a mask here, though.
No.
Okay. Well, let's give it a listen.
Or I could be.
All right. Well, here we go.
The difference courage makes up on stage with a mask and no name. You can step on me, but I won't break. And if I bend, you'll see what I can take. I figure the line was made for us. The shadow inside was made out of lust. You see it in trust. See the difference courage makes up on stage with a mask and no name. You can step on me, but I won't break. And if I bend, you'll see what I can take. I figure the line was made for us. The shadow inside was made out of lust. You see it in trust.
Tell us about the rest of your group. Do you have do you have a band name, or is it just you? Use your name.
No, well, we used to be called Jack Rush, and I play with the drummer as a two-piece for years. But this is kind of a starting over stage for us. The new band name is Twin Brother, and that came up from playing with the drummer for so long and feeling like so tight with him that we are pretty much brothers. And another reason is probably, well, my dad had a twin brother that passed away that was really important to my family. So there's kind of a double meaning in that. But it's not just us two anymore. We do have a bass player as well that really brings the songs together more than they were before as a two-piece, I'd say. And we do have a lot of special guests from time to time. At our CD release show on May 24th at Club Garibaldi, we have a lap steel player that's featured on a couple songs and also a viola player. So we do like to feature a lot of instruments. And on the album, there's a lot of different stuff going on.
You were an intern on Lake Effect. It seems to be a requirement these days to be a Lake Effect intern. And the those that are Lake Effect interns, I don't know. I just get a lot of insight into the local music scene. So I want to ask you to share your insights for what do you think the local scene is like. I mean, what music is accepted or popular, or is it difficult to get a recording contract? Is it difficult to actually find a studio to help you along, you know, that kind of thing?
Well, as far as making it big, getting a recording contract or whatever, I don't feel like that's tangible for myself. But I have seen some bands come out of Milwaukee recently that have actually been getting somewhere, which is exciting to me because I've been doing this here for about 7 or 8 years, and I haven't really seen much of that in the past. But Trapper Shep, another intern here,
yes,
opened for the Wallflowers and is doing really cool things. And Field Report is actually getting somewhere, and they were opening on tour with the Counting Crows. So they're doing stuff, and that's pretty cool. And there's some good music going on. But I feel the scene here is, I'm not really sure how to describe it. I know that I don't really seem to fit in too well with any certain genre or scene here. It seems like, for a while at least, you had to pull out all the stops and do as many weird or different things as possible to get any attention. You know, the more instruments you can play at once, the better, you know. Keyboard in one hand, guitar in the other, yeah, while you're hitting a kick drum or something.
And ride a unicycle, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I don't know. I try not to think about the rules and the categories, I guess, because it's just, I don't really understand it, to be honest with you. So.
All right. An honest answer.
Great. Yeah.
All right. Maybe if you can just tell us a little bit about the creation process, how you go about, because the song you just did for us, was that a song specifically written as a solo song, or is it accompanied by your band in other forms? And then what we heard coming into this interview segment, and then we'll play another song of yours going out, are more full band songs. So is there a difference between those creation processes?
Typically, for me, no. I tend to write the songs on a guitar and the vocals just by myself, solo. So I feel like they all are... can work playing them by myself, and they tend to morph into something else when I bring them to the band members and see how they feel about the songs. The creation process is a lot different now that we're playing with more than two people in a band. There are more ideas going around. There's more, actually it seems like a blank canvas when it was just me and Tyler and we had these songs and it's just guitar and drums, and almost anybody could have their own idea for where to go with it or what to do on it. So it's pretty interesting seeing what people do in the arrangements. Like we have a lot of string arrangements and some piano and things like that. It's definitely amazing sharing the creation of a song with other people. And I like that process a lot. But it all starts with guitar and vocals, just acoustic guitar and vocals. The one I played live here today was, I guess you could say it was meant to be solo. And it's solo on the album, but we play it all together live. So who knows, really?
And you are going to be performing live. You're going to be at Club Garibaldi, I believe.
Correct, yeah. Club Garibaldi.
Full band?
Full band.
Okay.
Yeah, May 24th.
Okay. Well, Sean, thank you for coming back in. It was great to have you as an intern, and it's great to have you as a guest as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I had a great time.
Did I mention you are someone to know of? 'Cause I breathe easy knowing that you bleed.
Sean Rosch and his band Twin Brother will play a CD release show tomorrow night at Club Garibaldi in glamorous Bayview. Their new album is a self-titled work, and we're listening to a track from it called What Am I Speaking Of? Sean Rosch spoke with Like Effect's Dan Harmon. That's Thursday's show. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.
What am I speaking?